Welcome once again to City Talk, and our guest is a lady whom, if you ever listen to radio and want to learn about history, you'll know this name. Her name is Donna Helper. She has been a radio historian for many, many years and a part of the Boston radio scene for a great many years as well. And Donna, it's a privilege to have you sitting here to be able to do this.
Well, it's my pleasure to be on your show, and I want to thank you for having me.
Oh, I wouldn't miss it. Now, you are, let's get started a little bit. You are originally from Dorchester.
I am. Mm-hmm. I was raised near Franklin Field. The neighborhood was very different in those days, but Dorchester has always been a neighborhood of immigrants. It has always been a neighborhood of, you know, people trying to get into the middle class. There, when I was growing up, there were a lot of Irish immigrants, a lot of Jewish immigrants. Today, you have different ethnic groups, but it's the same thing. It's still a neighborhood where people come to just get a start, move on up. Some people stay, some people leave. I have very happy memories of growing up in Dorchester. I'm not saying that just because I'm here. I'm like, you know, I still get back to the old neighborhood. Something I feel really bad about, though, the home that I spent my first, like, 7 or 8 years in, it burned down in a fire many years ago. So I don't have like a place that I can go and point to and say, hey, you know, that's where I grew up. But the other day, I found some old slides, okay, like from an old slide projector kind of slides. And some of them were from the home that I grew up in, and I hadn't seen them in years. We left for Roslindale when I was eight and a half or so. Nothing wrong with Dorchester, but just my parents wanted to have more kids, and we were living in like a really small place, so we moved. But yeah, I still have very fond memories of Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, that whole area.
From what I can gather, you, like me, and it's something that really can't be explained, had a bug about radio and wanted it and wanted to be in it. My parents gave me a tape recorder when I was 10 years old, and from then on, I was hooked on radio.
Oh, I totally get that. I knew from the time I was a kid that I wanted to be in radio. I had no idea there were no women in it, okay? I mean, I thought that the fact that there weren't any women, and when I say there weren't any women, I mean in top 40, because yes, there were women, but they were doing like the cooking show, the recipes, fashion, celebrity gossip. I had no idea that these things were what today we would call gendered. Okay, it was like the men did the sports, the women did the recipes. And when I listened to Top 40 when I was growing up, I didn't know that the reason the DJs were men was because they didn't let women be DJs. I had no idea. I just knew that I was a lonely kid, and the DJs were like my friends. It was just so excellent to hear them because they made me feel better. I was made fun of a lot in school. I was very different from the other girls of my generation. And again, had no idea. You know, when you're in the middle of it, you're not sitting there analyzing it. You know, I was just a kid. But the things that girls were supposed to want to do, I never wanted to do them. I never liked makeup. I couldn't have cared less about fashion. I mean, yeah, I like to look nice. Of course I do. But my favorite activity was not necessarily shopping, is what I'm saying. And there was this expectation that this is how girls were supposed to act. And I wanted a career. I knew I wanted a career from the time I was 4. You could ask my relatives. It was just, they were like, isn't that cute, you know? But that was it. Other girls were playing with their dolls. Their dolls were their babies. My dolls were my clients, my colleagues, my business associates. And what's really bizarre is I don't know where I got that from, okay? I didn't see businesswomen. It was the 50s, for heaven's sake. And I mean, just the stereotypic ways that girls were supposed to act. Boys were supposed to join the military, you know, and girls were supposed to get married right out of high school. I knew from the time I was 4 that I wanted to marry, but I didn't want to marry till I had a career established. And no one was talking that way. So when I listened to the radio, and you could probably relate to this, Ken, when I listen to the radio, radio is, of course, theater of the imagination. Like, if you're listening to us right now, what do we look like?
Yeah.
No, I'm serious. Exactly. I mean, are we well-dressed? Are we not well-dressed?
Exactly,
are we wearing, you know, a ball gown and a tuxedo? Or are we wearing jeans and a t-shirt? You don't know. But in your mind, you're imagining us. I myself am drop-dead gorgeous. I mean, what can I say? And Kenny's the most handsome guy I've ever seen.
Right.
But you get the point. I mean, I would listen to the DJs and I would imagine what they looked like. I would imagine. The great thing when I would listen to baseball games, and I've been a baseball fan since I was a kid, is the great radio announcers from back then. They could paint a picture with words. You felt like you were at the game. And I said to myself, my God, that's what I want to do. I want to make people happy the way the DJs and the announcers make me happy. I want to get into that line of work. I had no idea I was making a revolutionary statement for the 1950s, and yet I was. And I didn't know that when I went to college that I would become the first woman in the history of Northeastern University to ever be on the radio. I didn't know that. I just knew that I wanted to be on the air, and I went up and, you know, offered to be on the air, which, of course, they turned me down. But another story for another time. My point being, radio was a best friend for me.
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up in Rochester, New York, and I can sit here and rattle off names, times, radio stations of people that I used to listen to. For people here in Boston, who did you listen to when you were growing up?
Absolutely. My cultural hero was Arnie Ginsberg, Arnie Woo-Woo Ginsberg.
Yep.
And for those that are not familiar with Arnie, Arnie kind of talked like this. He had a very high, squeaky voice. Now, you may say, so what, Donna? Well, very large so what, because that was still the era
when guys were expected to kind of talk like this, you know, and I don't know why they were expected to talk like this, but that's how they were.
And Arnie didn't talk like that. Mm-hmm. Not only did he not have a big, deep voice, but he didn't have a name like John Smith or Joe Jones because, again, I didn't know this. But back then, there was a lot of bigotry, not just in society, but in the industry. And if you had an ethnic name, if you were Jewish, if you were Italian, if you were Greek, you were expected to get rid of your ethnic name and have something that was considered like it sounded more white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, okay? So Jim Semprakis became Jim Sands, okay? And Bob Clayton, his original name was Bob Clayman. Okay, and they said, well, that's too Jewish, you know. Bill Molya, M-O-G-L-I-A, became Bill Marlowe.
Oh,
exactly.
Goodness.
So I didn't know that's what was going on, but I did know that there was nobody like Arnie Ginsberg, and Arnie wouldn't change his name. So he had this big, you know, high squeaky voice, and he had this ethnic-sounding name, and he was having such fun on the radio. And I said to myself, wow, if he can do it, I can do it. But yeah, he was my cultural hero for sure. There were a lot of other people whose names I could drop that I don't know if your listeners would be familiar with. But the bottom line is, wherever you were, those DJs were your friends. And one of the things I feel bad about, and I emailed this to you a couple of times. We correspond on email.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, one of the things I feel bad about is kids today don't grow up with radio dreams. They don't grow up thinking like, wow, I'd like to be a DJ. They've grown up with Spotify, with Pandora, with all of the, you know, like I can be my own DJ. Yeah, but there's nothing like having some friendly person talking to you, somebody that is interacting with you. I think that's really a great loss when you don't have that in your life. But sadly, a lot of people don't have that in their life anymore. I think it's kind of a shame.
There are good and bad things to say about technology today. The good thing is it's a wonderful feeling to be able to sit in your living room and listen to Vince Scully in Los Angeles or John Miller in San Francisco or you name it, anywhere in the country, doing a hockey game or a basketball game. But at the same time, you don't have the companionship that you used to have with radio announcers.
And this is not like, oh, things were better in the good old days. No, they weren't better in the good old days. They were not. Okay, trust me, they were not. But on the other hand, there was a space where you could go to just kind of feel like you were being befriended. And that's what radio was for you. Marshall McLuhan, who is a great theorist. He wrote a number of books, some more readable than others, but he gets quoted a lot. He said stuff like the medium is the message, and, you know, referring to the fact that whichever mass medium you hear or see or experience through reading, depending on how you receive that message, the message changes. Like if I'm watching someone on TV and I'm listening to someone on the radio, the famous example of the Kennedy-Nixon debate in 1960, okay? If you could see the Kennedy-Nixon debate, you could see that John F. Kennedy was young and handsome. He really wasn't that young, but I'm saying he looked young, handsome, vibrant. He sounded confident, this and that. Nixon looked shifty. He looked sweaty. Now, we didn't know at the time. Nixon had a fever and had checked himself out of the hospital against medical advice just to be at the debate because he didn't want to seem like a wuss. So, you know, he didn't want to seem like, oh, sure, you know, he wouldn't come and debate John F. Kennedy. So he showed up, but he was sick as a dog, okay? And he looked awful. Now, the people that watched the debate, the presidential debate in 1960, they thought Kennedy won because he looked so good. The people that didn't watch it or couldn't watch it, because let's be honest, radio has been a lifeline for blind people since day one. But a lot of people were just, they were in their car, they were here, they couldn't watch it, okay? And they listened and they thought Nixon won, because Nixon sounded better prepared on the issues. So if you weren't distracted by the way he looked and you were just focusing on how he sounded, totally different. And that's what McLuhan was talking about. He said the medium changes the message. And he said radio is the most intimate medium. It makes you feel like you're eavesdropping on the world. There are conversations happening and you're kind of like a fly on the wall listening in to those conversations. And he is so right, God rest his soul. He was totally on to something when he wrote that way back in 1964. So, yeah, for me, for you, for a lot of us, radio has not just been a best friend, it's been a place where you could imagine just about anything. And I really do think kids have lost some of that by not being attached to radio the way we were.
Before we discuss radio history and the way things evolved in Boston, I always find it fascinating how people got started in radio broadcasting. And you got started by having a gentleman that was also my boss later on at WBZ.
Absolutely. Rick Starr at WCAS in Cambridge.
I remember that station. It ain't that anymore.
Oh, I know.
But I remember when it was back then.
And it was a dinky little daytimer. It did not have the biggest signal. Although, thanks to the magic of technology, it you couldn't get it like 3 miles down the road, and yet you could get it down in Provincetown because the signal would just go right across the water. And, you know, I had listeners in Provincetown. Imagine my surprise.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was my first radio job. It didn't pay a ton of bucks. I didn't care. It had taken me like 4.5 years to get anybody that would hire me. Not because I was horrible, but because I was female and the industry still hadn't changed. When I went up in college in 1964 to try to get my first radio job at the college station, and I didn't know I was the first woman. I had no idea. I just knew that I wanted to be on the air. And so I went up to the station, and I said to the station manager, you know, hey, I'm here. I'd like to audition. And they said, like, you can't. And I said, why not? And they said, well, because you're female. I think they used because you're a girl. And I said, well, yeah, but what's your point? He said, we don't have girls on the air. I said, why not? He said, they don't sound good. I said, well, how many have you had on the air? He said, none. They don't sound good. And that kind of seemed like catch 22. If you've never had any on the air, how come, you know, how do you know they don't? Yeah. But that's what I ran into over and over and over, even after I finally, in October of 1968, became the first woman announcer in Northeastern University's history. And even though I had tons of fans, and I'm not saying, like, aren't I swell, but I did. Somehow the Republic didn't fall. I mean, going through those old boxes where I found the old slides, I also found some fan letters that people sent me when I was on the air at Northeastern. And evidently, people liked my show. The Republic did not fall, like I said. So after I graduated, I just went out there trying to find a radio job in commercial radio and found that no one would hire me. And I just kept – back then they could come right out and tell you. It's like, we don't hire girls, you know, or we don't hire insert the name of minority or whatever. They just would come out and say it, which is kind of sad when you think about it. But I, you know something? I never wanted to get a job because I was a woman. I never wanted, oh, you know, we need a woman at this station. I just didn't want to be excluded from a job because I'm a woman. If I'm qualified, hire me. If I'm not qualified, don't hire me. But my gender shouldn't have anything to do with it. And sadly, at that time, it still did. So when Rick Starr, years after, I kept trying and trying, and I got a lot of behind-the-scenes work. I mean, I worked at ABC Radio as a writer and a researcher, but they'd never let me on the air. So finally, in 1973, I was teaching at the Boston Public Schools to, you know, got to pay that rent. And Rick Starr hired me. And those were some of the happiest days of my life. I mean, I was teaching in the morning and then going in the afternoon and be an afternoon drive at WCAS. And when I finally had an opportunity to work full-time in radio, even though I had to leave Boston and go to Cleveland to do it, I left tenure. I was like 6 or 8 months away from being tenured in the Boston Public Schools. No offense to the Boston Public Schools. I very much enjoyed teaching at Hyde Park High School, had a lot of fun, made some friends. I'd like to believe I made a difference there. But it wasn't where my heart was. My heart was in radio. And when I had a chance to work in radio full time, I took it. And I left the only home I've ever known, Massachusetts, and went off to Cleveland to begin the great radio adventure that became my career. So there you go.
Yep, I know exactly what you're talking about. I was never so excited when I started working at WBZ Radio. The first person I ever had to contact for Gil Santos was Angelo Dundee.
Oh, my God.
The manager of Muhammad Ali at that time. And I thought to myself, wow. I'm getting paid to do this.
Oh, I know. It's amazing.
And I get to talk to these people.
Yep. I get to meet all these celebrities.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
How lucky am I?
Exactly.
I cannot. I mean, if we could just spend like an hour and a half name dropping, it would be just, you know, it would be boring for the audience, but it would be fun for, hey, you know this one? Yeah, but
exactly.
I met that one. Yeah, but I saw this one. Yeah, but I had lunch with that one, you know.
Well,
wow.
And
you get paid.
And you have to remember, too, that at that time.
Didn't get paid a lot, but we got paid.
You had three major television stations who all had their own individual talk shows.
Yep.
So this town was loaded with celebrities.
Absolutely.
And BZ had People Are Talking with Sonia Hamlin and then Tom Bergeron. And you never knew. I mean, I walked in this I'll tell you a story. In 1971, when I was at BZ, we celebrated our 50th anniversary on the air. One of the people that we had that I absolutely fell in love with and who was one of my heroes when I was growing up was Art Linkletter.
Oh, my God, Art Linkletter.
Loved him to death. And I was in the station one day and somebody said to me, hey, Art Linkletter is over on the television side. Well, that was all I needed. So I went over to BZTV, introduced myself, and he remembered me and I said, listen, have you got 10 or 15 minutes to come over to the radio and sit down and tape an interview? And he said, listen, if we haven't got time, we'll make time. And somebody told me later they didn't know who had a bigger grin on their face, Art Linkletter or me.
Now, I had heard, all joking aside, and some of our listeners may not know who Art Linkletter was, but he had these really heartwarming shows where there were kids on the air, you know, kids. What was the name of that show of his?
It was Art Linkletter's House Party.
That was the original. original one, but what was the one with the kids where
kids
he would
say the darndest?
It was Kids Say the Darndest Things kind of show, you know?
That was a feature of the show.
Yep. But he turned that into like an entire thing where he would get kids on the air and ask them questions. But it wasn't done in a mean way. It wasn't done to prank them. It was done to just like, this is how kids look at the world. And it was just so cute. I mean, those kids were adorable.
Oh, yeah.
And
he's got books on it and everything.
Yes. I'm very curious about what he was like as a person because, sadly, a lot of the folks that I met and possibly some of the ones you met as well had egos the size of a house, whereas there were others that were just the nicest, most down-to-earth people. And I've heard good things about Art Linkletter.
He was absolutely wonderful. He was wonderful that day. And then he was doing some motivational speaking along with Jesse Owens, the Olympic star.
Yes.
And I went and saw them both perform and got to meet and talk with Linkletter even more. And I loved him to death. He was absolutely one of the neatest people in the entire world.
You know what I feel bad about is that a lot of the audio from back in those days has not been preserved. Some of it has, but there's an entire period of time, like in the 30s and the 40s, when some of the greats were just getting started, when they were up and coming. And the stuff, it wasn't preserved. First of all, the technology wasn't quite there. I mean, transcription didn't really become – it got created around 1929 and didn't start getting into common use till the mid-30s. But there's so many shows, particularly at the local level, that I wish I could have heard. It would have been just so fascinating. And we just don't have them. And that's kind of a shame. Linkletter, I think we've got a lot of audio from him.
A great deal of people are funny.
Yes.
But I haven't found much from his house party shows.
No, nor have I.
But I found a lot of People Are Funny, which was on another network. It was on NBC and a completely different show from Art Linkletter.
Oh, I still remember the theme song. I won't bore you with trying to sing it, but
I remember it too.
Yep,
so we're even.
Absolutely.
But you are a radio historian.
I am.
Let us talk about two things. Number one, what made you decide to do that? And number two, everybody knows BZ was the first licensed radio station in Boston in 1921. But when and how long did it take other stations to catch up?
Actually, everybody doesn't know that because it's kind of semi-not true. WBZ was actually the second station in Greater Boston. The first was a little station at Medford Hillside on the campus of Tufts, except it wasn't a college station. It was a commercial station called 1XE. The X stood for experimental. And it later became WGI, and it was Boston's first station. WBZ, God bless them, was not in Boston back then. WBZ was out in Springfield. So the first Boston station was 1XE WGI, and it only had like 100 wonderful watts, you know, the mice ran the treadmill, that kind of thing. But it made a tremendous difference for people because it was the first time they could hear their favorite songs. There was a woman announcer on the station named Eunice Randall. There were African-American performers. They had one of the first performances by an African-American, a guy by the name of Charles Gilpin, did a reading on the air. I believe it was in April of 1922. You may say, so what, Donna? Very large, so what? Because it was a segregated society, let's be honest. And while Boston was not de jure segregated, it was de facto. And there were still a lot of places where people of color couldn't go. And on radio, you could go anywhere. There were black performers. You could hear them in cities that were totally segregated. I mean, there were black artists who were performing on the air up here in the North, and their music and their entertainment and their performances of stage plays and this and that, they were being heard down in the South because AM signals traveled like nothing you've ever seen. AM signals still travel long distances. WBZ is heard in, what, 38 states? So the fact is that little 1XE WGI became the first station in the market, and then it was followed by WNAC, which is today WRKO. WNAC went on the air in late July of 1922. WBZ is out in Springfield at the time at the Westinghouse plant on Page Boulevard. They realized fairly quickly that you couldn't get the big name celebrities in Springfield that you could get in Boston. No offense to Springfield. They were getting their share of celebrities. But all the action was really taking place in Boston. So in February of 1924, they finally opened up a Boston studio. And that's when they came to Boston. But you're asking, how did this all interest me? Well, when I was a kid growing up, it didn't. I just, you know, it was like Arne Ginsberg's my favorite DJ. And then later on, I love Bruce Bradley and Jefferson K and all these other folks. But when I got on the air, finally, in October of 1968, like most people, you always wonder, who were the other people that went through this? Because I'd kind of like to talk to them, you know, just share a little story, you know, hey, did you have to wait X number of years before somebody would let you on the air, blah, blah, blah. And also, who were my mothers? Who were the people in the industry that did this first? And I looked in the history books of the day, nothing. Crickets. Nada. Most of the early broadcasting history books focused on the technology. Most of them focused on, you know, people like Marconi and Fessenden and David Sarnoff and various folks at the major corporations like Westinghouse, Frank Conrad. Yep. And it was like, it was very, very white and it was very, very male. And again, that just kind of made me wonder. Nothing against males. I mean, come on, I've been married for 30 years, got no problem with guys. But I do have a problem with leaving people out of history. Okay? If somebody did something, tell their story. Include them. So that set me, without realizing it, that set me on a search. I didn't know at the time that it would become books, it would become articles, it would become Donna Becomes a Media Historian. At first, it was just curiosity. And I couldn't believe there hadn't been any women except for the occasional singer. And I decided, you know, I'm going to find out. There's got to be people that were there. And as it turned out, yeah, there not only were a couple, there were enough for me to do a 400-page book called Invisible Stars, A Social History of Women in American Broadcasting. I did the first edition in 2001. And then when the internet era helped a lot of stuff get digitized, I did a second edition in 2014. And those like 14 or 15 years really made a big difference because there were so many newspapers that were now online in their archives. I mean, I could read about the women that were on the air and the people of color that were on the air in other cities. I could read historical black newspapers. I could read magazines that had articles about the great women who did non-traditional things. And that's how I found women engineers and women announcers. That's how I found out about Eunice Randall. I was looking for something entirely different for a talk I was giving. I was at the Boston Public Library going through old microfilm, and I was reading the Boston Traveler, a long-defunct newspaper. I think it died a painful death in 1967 or something like that. But in its day, it was pretty important. And I'm reading a column by a guy named – by a guy, and that was his name, Guy. Guy Entwistle. God rest Guy Entwistle's soul, because I had no idea – that he was the first radio columnist in Boston. And he covered Little 1XE, which later became WGI. And he covered a whole bunch of other radio comings and goings in Boston. And thanks to him, the people at that station, their names were preserved. And one day, like I said, I'm just reading this old microfilm looking for something else for a talk I'm going to give. And it talks about this woman announcer at 1XE, I'm like, woman announcer at 1XE? Really? Because we're talking 1921. That's much earlier than anything I've seen. And it talks about how people loved her voice and she was getting marriage proposals. And, oh, by the way, she's reading the news. And I'm like, reading the news? Really? She wasn't like just a singer? And the more I researched, the more fascinated I got. And it just kind of reinforced for me, yeah, there are stories that need to be told. And I've spent my life telling those stories, both in public speaking events, where I kind of bring in all my rare memorabilia, and in programs like this one, where I get the opportunity to just sit and talk about some of these great historical personages who, in their day, really made a difference. Eunice Randall was unique, not just because, like, wow, Donnie, you found her, but check it out. She was a draftswoman. Back in those days, most people were men, draftsmen, okay? But she wanted to be called a drafts lady. She did technical drawings, did them excellently well. She repaired equipment. She became a ham radio operator. She climbed up the tower and did maintenance. I mean, she did stuff that women of her generation weren't doing. She would demonstrate. She worked for a company called the American Radio and Research Company, better known as AMRAD. And she would go off to trade shows and demonstrate their equipment, and not demonstrate it like sitting there in a dress looking adorable. I mean, she was a very nice-looking person, but she knew how to, you know, how the equipment worked because she'd helped to make it. So she was just quite unique for her time, and she was also a radio announcer, and she did the bedtime stories for the little kiddies. She was one of the first story ladies. Now, that was kind of gendered. Okay, fine, women read the stories. But she did other stuff as well. She did the police reports. She read the news. And because radio was live back in those days, tape hadn't been invented, if a guest didn't show up, she would sing. Because you had to keep the station on the air. She and one of the engineers would sing duets, which was kind of, God, I wish there were tape back in those days. Oh, I'd pay money to listen to that. But my point is, I found out that there were all kinds of Eunice Randalls. I found out that every city just about had a woman announcer. You know, maybe the woman announcer did something typical like storytelling, but in other cases, I even found the first woman to own a radio station way back in 1922 in Vinton, Iowa.
Oh, my goodness.
Her name was Marie Zimmerman, and she had a rare egalitarian marriage. I mean, yes, she took her husband's name, which in 1923 there was actually a legal case where a woman named Ruth Hale, who didn't want to take her husband's name, she loved her husband, but she was Ruth Hale and she was a reporter, and she wanted to continue to be Ruth Hale even after she married, and that got to be this big legal thing. But long before that, Marie Zimmerman, she just, you know, did what was customary in her day. She took her husband's name. She married a guy named Bob Zimmerman. You may say, so what, Donna? Well, Bob was an electrician, and both of them were interested in ham radio. And he said to her, hey, this radio craze is happening. You like radio? I like radio. We're listening to all these stations. Our city doesn't have one. How would you like to put a radio station on the air? I'll build it. You run it. And this was just like unheard of in those days. But that happened. He put a station in a truck. She drove it around the city. It was kind of like a portable radio station. They also had a studio. And this is what they did in Vinton, Iowa for a year. They ran out of money. They were just two, you know, ordinary human beings. They weren't fabulously wealthy. But for a year, Vinton had a station. And nobody in Vinton, Iowa knew that story until I was able to recreate it, tell her story, and bring her back. And some of her living relatives had no idea. And they were just like, wow, she was a pioneer in radio. Yeah, she had a licensed station in 1922, 1923. First woman to ever do it. So I was finding stories like that. Like I said, that's been my avocation and my passion for many, many years now.
You're a baseball fan.
I am. Hey, you know what just happened to me? I gave a talk at Cooperstown.
Ah.
And there was this symposium, this baseball symposium. A lot of people don't know that I'm also a baseball historian. Mostly the early years, because a lot of fascinating stuff happened back then. And I also focus on the sports writers, like who they were and what they were up to, because they kept the game alive for people. And thanks to their writings, we know a lot about the people and the places back in those days.
Kurt Smith.
Yes, Voices of the Game.
Yes.
I have quoted from him on more than one occasion.
Wonderful book.
But
wonderful
anyway,
guy.
So I was at Cooperstown, and I gave a talk about 6 or 7 months ago at a baseball symposium, and I gave a talk about women sports writers. And a lot of people think women sports writers are kind of a modern thing, like, wow, now you got all of these women that can go into the locker room and they can, you know, write about the game and they're on the beat. And there was a woman head of the Baseball Writers Association in 2012, and Claire Smith just won the J.G. Taylor Spink Award for, you know, outstanding sports writing. And people think it's modern. And of course, being the media historian that I am, when somebody says, oh, yeah, that's never happened before, that's kind of like a red flag in front of a bull. You know, it's like, never yep. happened before? Really? Yep. I'll bet it happened before. And so I went and traced it back. And I found women sports writers in the 1900s. There was one in like the 1890s. But I found one in the early 1900s, like 1905 to 1912, who was so well known that she covered the World Series in 1908. She sat in the press box with the men reporters and was treated like just a reporter.
Just one of the guys.
Absolutely. And in fact, she was nominated for an honorary membership in the Baseball Writers Association when it was founded in 1908. Her name was Ina Eloise Young. She later became Ina Young Kelly when she got married. And she was given an honorary membership because she didn't come from a major market. You know, back then the original sports writers were people that covered major league and minor league teams. She lived in Trinidad, Colorado, and basically covered semi-pro. But it didn't matter. She knew sports so well that her newspaper sent her to the 1908 World Series between Detroit and the Chicago Cubs. And she covered it. She was, like, syndicated, for heaven's sake. And very, very accepted. And after I found her, I found some other women that were covering sports, and I found two African-American sports writers, two women who covered baseball in the 1930s and the 1940s. And I found that Time magazine had a woman sports editor, and they wouldn't let her sit in the press box. Shame on them. But, you know, I found all of these women, and I was like, wow, I think I'll make a pitch to Cooperstown, to their baseball symposium, and see if they'll let me present. They did. And I just found out that my presentation is going to be included in the annual book that they put out about the best presentations in the symposium this past year.
Did you work with Jeff Idelson?
Oh, yeah. I know, you know, the people that were at that. This is not a humble brag, okay? I'm new at this, okay? I've been doing media history for decades. But baseball history, that's really only been in the past few years, almost kind of like a sideline to my media history work, just trying to, you know, history of broadcasting is what I know the best. But a lot of the sports writers, as it turned out, also went on the radio. So there was this intersection. I'm like, wow, you know, even in the 1920s, I mean, Mel Webb, God bless him, who wrote sports for the Boston Globe. And there he is in 1928 giving a radio talk. How cool is that? So I decided to just take a look at the early sports writers who I was interested in anyway, because I grew up reading baseball in the newspapers. And I decided to, like I said, find out if any of them were women or minorities. Turned out there were a lot of minority sports writers writing for the historically black newspapers. But there were even a few that wrote for the, you know, historically white newspapers. There was a guy named Doc Counts, who was the first black sports writer to get a press pass at Fenway Park. And so these are all the stories that I've been telling, you know, more recently. And it's just incredible to be able to make sure that they're being remembered. But since I didn't have the expertise that, let's say, a Kurt Smith or some of those good folks have, it was just incredible. When they got in touch with me a couple of weeks ago and said, hey, you're going to be in the annual book, I'm like, wow, me? And yet there I was. So, you know, thank God for that. And what a privilege.
And baseball was on WHDH in Boston for 30 years.
Oh, God. When I was a kid, okay, and I've always been a night person, okay, all my life. My father would despair of the whole thing because he was a morning person and he'd have to get me up to go to school in the morning, you know. Bring in a brass band. I wasn't going to wake up. You kidding me? But late at night, you could, if you had earphones, you know, today they're called earbuds, but, you know, you put on your phones and, like, hide them under your pillow so your parents couldn't see them, and you took your transistor radio, and you listened to the game. And I could get WBAL in Baltimore. Right. I could listen to the Orioles. Oh, my God. The stations that came into Boston late at night, broadcast band DXing, it was called. DXing, from ham radio, distance listening, like listening to stations far away, and I could get the game from all kinds of places. And oh, yeah, you know, at night when I was supposed to be going to sleep, I'd be very quietly just listening to the radio and listening to the baseball games. Absolutely.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, the same thing. One of the things that I always liked back then, I don't know if it's so true today, but every major league ball club had an announcer who was a star. The Cardinals had Harry Carey. The Yankees had my hero, Mal Allen. The Red Sox had Kurt Gowdy. The Tigers had Ernie Harwell, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if that's necessarily true today.
Yeah, and they all had catchphrases. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yep, Mal Allen had, how about that?
Yep.
And Ernie Harwell, would when somebody struck out, he would say, like a house standing on the side of the road.
Absolutely. And now, it's interesting. This isn't going to be baseball, but maybe some of you remember growing up listening to basketball. Johnny Most.
Johnny Most.
Johnny, oh, high above courtside.
Right.
Yep. God, I'm
ready to do a basketball battle.
Yes, absolutely.
Love Johnny.
I mean, he's a filthy, dirty player. Yeah, of course, that was the other team. The Celtics, I mean, they spent their time reading the Bible. But the other team, a filthy, dirty player. I was like, whoa, okay then. But again, as I said earlier, they made you feel like you were there, okay? Funny story. I know you want to talk baseball for a second, but when I was a kid growing up, like I said, the great announcers fascinated me. And mm-hmm. so I got into listening to Johnny Most. I hadn't particularly been a basketball fan, but he made me one because he just was so passionate about it.
Exactly.
And I still remember the team at that time. It was Heinsohn and Luskatov at the forwards, Russell at center, Sharman and Kuzi at the guards, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's how he'd say, Heinsohn and Luskatov at the forwards, Russell at center, Sharman and Kuzi at the guards.
Swish!
Yes. You know, yes, exactly. And so I was going to Sunday school, religious school back then, and it was at a place on American Legion Highway called the Hecht House. Long gone and hard to find. It's something else now. But back then, it was kind of a gathering place for the Jewish community, and other people used it too. But the Jewish community used to hold services there and events and also like Sunday school. And so I would go and I find out that they have a gym. And who's practicing in the gym? Some of the Celtics, okay? Now, they're not Jewish. They just, it was a good gym and they rented it and there you go, you know? So I'm supposed to be like reading the Bible and the people that I hear about on the radio are like right across the hall, you know? And I tell the teacher I gotta use the facilities. She must have thought I had a bladder disease. I didn't come back for like 15 minutes, but I was watching the Celtics practice. I saw Tommy Heinsohn. I got an autograph. I mean, these are the things that when you're a kid, these are gold. You can't believe you're sitting there, you know? And yeah, when I would listen to Kurt Gowdy or some of the others that I was able to hear late at night on the radio, it made me feel like I was at the game. It was incredible for me. Must have been great for you as well.
Oh, absolutely. Mel Allen was my hero. Nobody was better.
How about that?
Exactly. Nobody was better than Mel Allen. And that's with all due respect to Vin Scully.
Oh, I love Vin Scully.
But you have to remember that at that time, we, because of being on the East Coast, we didn't hear Vin Scully.
No.
Because Scully broadcast exclusively in Brooklyn and then in
Los Angeles, yeah.
And once satellite radio came in and CBS Radio got the World Series and Scully started doing play-by-play there, then he became more of a household word.
Now, but, here in Boston, your original announcer...
Jim Britt.
Before Jim Britt. On radio, of course, it was Fred Hoy.
Yes.
And before Fred, it was a combination of, Gus Rooney from the Boston Traveler, Charlie Donlin from the Boston Traveler. They basically, had sports writers, just like, here, anybody want to make a few extra bucks? We get this new thing called broadcasting, and congratulations, you're on the air. I just wrote a piece for the Baseball Research Journal, which your listeners may or may not be able to get. It's online via SABR, the Society of American Baseball Research. And the Baseball Research Journal comes out like four times a year, and I had the privilege of being in their new issue, writing about how radio changed the experience of baseball for the fans. Because the fans, up to that point, if you wanted to, interact with the game, you had to go. And if you're a working class person in the 19-teens or 1920s, you may or may not be able to get time off from work. In fact, it was very interesting. Back in those days, there was a place in downtown Boston called Newspaper Row. It was on Lower Washington Street, just not too far from where all the department stores used to be. And a bunch of newspapers had their offices there, including the Boston Globe, the Boston Post, and a whole bunch of others. And they would put out on chalkboards the scores of the ball games. Mm-hmm. They'd get them by telegraph, and then the newsboys and a couple of newsgirls would go running down to the chalkboards. And, every inning it was Red Sox score. And then people would just stand outside on their lunch hour watching the chalkboards to find out what was happening at the game. But when radio came along, suddenly the game was right in your living room or your radio room, whatever room you put your big old radio in. And it made a tremendous amount of difference. But there had always been a mystery. Who was the first announcer of the first game that was ever broadcast in Boston? And it was broadcast on WBZ in 1925. It was a Braves game. And nowhere was there a record of who it was, okay? I'm WBZ's historian. I was for many years. Mm-hmm. And I have all the notes from the original logs and this and that. It mentions they aired the game. Never says who the announcer was.
So we still don't know who the announcer was.
Oh, Auntie Donna knows.
Who was it?
Believe it or don't, it was the vaudeville comedian Joe E. Brown.
Oh, my goodness.
Who had been a big baseball fan for years. There was a cartoonist. His name was Abraham Savransky, but in the era of changing your name, he became Abe Savran, and everybody called him Sav, S-A-V. And in fact, if you go to old microfilm of the Boston Traveler, because it's still not digitized, the later years are, the early ones are not. Thank you, Boston Public Library, for your awesome microfilm collection. And I was going through old microfilm, as I often do. And back in those days, the sports cartoonists would do a recap of the game. This was the pre-television era. So if you couldn't be there, you could read the sports writers telling you, who hit the home run, who made the bad play. And then the sports cartoonists would take four columns, four panels to just do kind of cartoon versions. Here's Joe Smith striking out. Here's John Jones throwing that major pitch, this kind of thing. And I found a cartoon from Sav, who was the big sports cartoonist in The Traveler. And there's four panels of the Braves opener, and it's the usual, this guy struck out, this guy had a hit, blah, blah, blah. And in the fourth panel, there's Joe E. Brown broadcasting the game.
Oh,
and it
wow.
says in the cartoon that, it was so great to hear Joe E. Brown. And I'm like, ah, if I just solved the mystery. And I did some digging in terms of, was he in town at that time? Yes, he was. Was he at Fenway Park, Braves Field, rather? Yes, he was. Could all of this, Abe Savransky, Sav, had brought him to town to speak at an Elks Club dinner. Oh. He was being honored. So he was in town anyway. And he was a big baseball fan. They didn't have any sports broadcasters yet. So he kind of stepped in and did the game. When the games went to WNAC the next year, and both the Red Sox and the Braves were on, Gus Rooney did the first one. They did a whole bunch of other sports writers for, that year. And then they finally, the next year, settled on Fred Hoy, who already had a long history in town as a former athlete, a scorer, a sports writer. I mean, you name it. He'd been the official scorer at a bunch of games. Just an incredible presence. He knew the game inside and out, and he was like the first major Boston radio announcer who did the games. And he did them well into the late 1930s.
I find it hard to believe, knowing what radio is like today, that back in those days, a lot of ball clubs did not want to broadcast Major League Baseball on the radio because they thought it would decrease attendance.
Well, it wasn't just the clubs. There were vocalists who were afraid that if they sang on the radio, no one would buy their records. There were performers who were like, if I give a stage reading of, Macbeth or whatever, I'm on the Boston stage, they won't come to my performances. People misunderstood. There were all these articles. I mentioned this in my book. There were all these articles that were doom and gloom. Radio will be the end of reading. Radio will be the end of conversation. No one will go to a concert. Turned out it had the opposite effect. People would hear someone on the radio, and they'd want to see them live. They'd hear about the baseball games. Like, wow, I want to go. They'd hear about, the great Caruso was quite dead, although radio brought him back to life. But they'd hear about people singing the works of the great Caruso. It was like, wow, where are you performing? I want to see you. And so it had just the opposite effect. It made people want to go even more. Even when the Red Sox were losing, which when radio came along, that was the era where both the Red Sox and the Braves, they couldn't win a ball game to save their lives. But people they loved the way Fred Hoy described the game. It sounded pretty interesting to them, and so they wanted to go. So it became the kind of situation where the ball clubs finally had to relent and go, yeah, we got to have more games rather than less.
Donna, we're running out on time here.
I'm so sorry. But, I hope I haven't taken up too much.
But give yourself a plug. Is there a website or a book that people can contact
you? Well, I blog. Put me on the Google, just Donna Halper. But my website is www.donnahalper.com. D-O-N-N-A-H-A is in applesauce. L-P is in pony, E-R. DLH at DonnaHalper.com is my email. So website, www.DonnaHalper.com. Please feel free to get in touch if you have radio history questions, if there's stuff you want to talk about. I also blog. I do podcasts. And I really am privileged to have been on your show. Thank you so much for having me.
I can say the same thing. It's an honor to have someone who, like me, loves radio history.
And still does.
And still does, absolutely. And it's being made every day. I don't know if it's as well as it used to be, but it's still being made. And
there's still some great personalities on the air. I mean, we didn't have a chance to talk about people like Maddie Siegel over at Kiss, the Morning.
Yep.
Wherever you're listening, there are important people on the air doing news, doing talk, doing music. They're still your friends. They're still people you can relate to. And I'm so glad to be a part of it. Kenny, thank you. I love you dearly. And thank you to everyone who listened.
I feel the same way. It's been a real pleasure to have you here. Will you come back sometime?
You know something? This is why you pay me the big bucks. So, no, this is where my heart is. It's always a privilege to talk about the history of radio. And there's so many more people we didn't get a chance to talk about.
Good heavens.
So, yeah.
We could do 2 or 3 hours.
If you want me to come back, it would be my pleasure.
I would love to have you come back.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.